And he would have been the Pharaoh that Moses fled from. And so the father of the Pharaoh of the Exodus. And so we have his pyramid. And remember when I was talking about one of the interesting coincidences, I'll say evidence, for that timeline is that at that time the pharaohs were building pyramids made out of mud brick. Pyramids which did not last. So when you think of the pyramids, like Pyramid of Giza, and that, it's not those pyramids. This is Amenemhat's pyramid, what's left of it. So they did not stand the test of time. So probably if you take the pyramid tour, if you go to Egypt, this is probably not one that they're going to take you to see. It's kind of a big pile of rubble, but that's because, but it's quite large. You can see people up there. And so, anyway. I don't know, but I believe they did not survive. Or if they did, you wouldn't want to go in. I don't know that anybody, so as far as I've heard, I don't think anybody is like dug into the middle of it. Probably be a huge effort, but it would probably be life-threatening if you did. So some of the pyramids are pretty dangerous. So, also one other bit of odds and ends. I thought this was interesting. This is from an Egyptian wisdom poem, and the poem is called Satire on the Trades. And I think it just gives us a little bit of insight as to what corvée slavery was like. And so this describes, he's not talking specifically about the Israelites here as far as we know. He's just talking about the brick trade in general. And essentially the laborers who would make bricks. And so he says of the brick worker, he is dirtier than vines or pigs from treading under the mud. His clothes are stiff with clay. His leather belt is going to ruin. Entering into the wind, he is miserable. His sides ache. His arms are destroyed with technical work. He washes himself only once a season. He is wretched through and through. So that is the life of a brickmaker. And so we know the Israelites were forced into corvée slavery, making bricks, probably by the tens of millions. They needed them for the pyramids. So that's probably what life would have been like. So a little bit of historical color, I guess. Last week, so we talked about a theory as to placing the pharaohs into the timeline, but I actually want to address something that I think is just as interesting, maybe even more so, and that is, why doesn't the Bible tell us who the pharaoh is? Because it's really one of the great mysteries, in a sense, of biblical history, because there's really no indication. So, first of all, quick trivia survey. Does anybody know who Horatio Gates was? No. he is somebody from American history. And I'll be totally honest with you, if I were in your place, I may not be able to answer this either. Okay. What was that? No, nothing to do with Bill Gates as far as I know. All right, question number two. Who was Benedict Arnold? A traitor, right. Everybody, raise your hand if you know who Benedict Arnold was. I think everybody does. Okay. He was a treacherous general. The reason why I ask who Horatio Gates was is because both Horatio Gates and Benedict Arnold were heroes at the decisive Battle of Saratoga in the American Revolution. Horatio Gates was the commanding general. He was Benedict Arnold's commander. And so Saratoga was arguably one of the most decisive, maybe the most decisive single battle in American history, because it largely determined that there would be a United States. It was probably the most decisive battle of the American Revolution. And Horatio Gates was the commanding general. Benedict Arnold was a hero, a very well-known hero, but they were both really heroes from the battle. Benedict Arnold displayed a lot of bravery and a lot of cunning on the battlefield and was largely responsible for winning the battle. So, The question is, they were both heroes, both from the same battle, very decisive battle. Why do we as Americans tend to recognize that name, whereas we don't really remember that name? Because actually the answer, you gave earlier. Because subsequent to the battle, he betrayed the cause of the United States. He betrayed the cause. And so, therefore, he is America's most infamous traitor. So, that seems fairly obvious. But then the question is, why would we remember a bad guy and we don't really remember the commanding general? He was basically the only other general who is equal in rank to George Washington. I think he was not nearly as decisive, as pivotal a character as Washington. But he was of equal rank. He was one of the few people that was not really, he didn't really have to ask Washington for permission in that sense. He was not a subordinate. And so the answer is, I think that we have a particular type of culture that we just take so much for granted that we don't really think about it. We remember our enemies, and we remember infamous people more so than we remember heroic people, or than we remember decisive people who were, you know, fighting for the cause. So we remember the Benedict Arnolds more than we remember the Horatio Gates. And so we tend to remember our enemies and our infamous. And there are other cultures that are like this too, some of them biblical cultures. So Germany tends to be a little bit more like we are, no surprise, since we're very much a product of German culture and Anglo-Saxon English and Celtic culture. In biblical times, Assyria was like that. If you look, when you read the Old Testament prophets, in the portions about Assyria and the late New Testament, you have lots of names. The Assyrians love recording the names of all the kings that they squash. So they record their enemies, which is why the Assyrian period is so well known, because we can go back into Assyrian history, and the Bible, the prophets, mimic this. In a sense, they kind of participate in this broader culture. So when you read those portions of Scripture, you get lots of names. You get the names of their enemies, and God will give us, the prophets will give us, the names of the Assyrian emperors. Sennacherib, Esarhaddon, Sargon, etc. Other cultures are the opposite, and this is a little bit foreign to us. Other cultures erase the infamous. For example, if Benedict Arnold had been in the Soviet Union, you would have absolutely no idea who he was. You would have never heard of his name before. They would have erased everything that had to do with him. Every picture, every mention in every document, his birth record, going back to his birth, his school papers, everything, they would have been destroyed. They would have wiped out all memory of him. It would have been as if he never existed. The Soviet... Mm-hmm.
You're saying the Soviet Union.
I know that the Soviets specialized at it. I actually am not really sure about Russian culture in general, like pre-Soviet Russian culture. I was kind of wondering about that as I was preparing this, but honestly, I don't know enough to say. I would suspect maybe so. I don't know if anybody knows. But maybe the Tsars did, because probably the Soviets got it from somewhere. Ancient Rome tended to be like that. There were Roman emperors that subsequent emperors attempted to erase. And importantly for our topic, ancient Egypt was like that. And I'll give you some examples. So therefore, you don't name your enemies. Whenever the ancient the pharaohs a lot of times were at war with the kings of the Hittites. The Hittites were kind of their alter ego, a doppelganger. And so whenever the pharaoh referred to a Hittite king, he always referred to him as the king of Hatti, never referred to him by name, because he didn't want his name preserved. Always the king of Hatti. So now as we're kind of talking about God relating to Pharaoh, God never refers to him by name. So he's kind of participating in that. He's speaking to him in the language of that culture. But Pharaoh is the enemy. And so we find out also that Moses follows this practice. The Romans gave a name to this practice called damnatio memoriae, literally the damnation of memory, total destruction of the memory of somebody. So let me give you a few examples. There are great examples from the Soviet Union, because in the age of photography, they did this in their photographs. This, of course, is Joseph Stalin. And this gentleman, as you know, Stalin purged a lot of people in the 1930s. Purged meaning executed. Not only executed, but then wiped out their memory. So they went through photos like this, and they touched them up a little bit. That guy disappears. So that's visual damnatio memoriae. That's what the Egyptians and the Romans did, except for I think the Soviet example is pretty graphic. The only reason we have these pictures were difficult to find because they were ones that they missed. And you can tell in all of these that the photo image quality goes down when they touch them up. That's how you know which one is the original. Well, that and they wouldn't paint in somebody. But here's a picture of Lenin with some of his cohorts. And that guy fell out of favor with Vladimir Lenin. Now, this one wasn't Trotsky, I don't think. Yeah. You know, I bet there are pictures of Trotsky where he was obliterated. So he goes away. This one is interesting. There's like four people here that were purged. Here, pay attention.
Wow.
They went through extra effort on that one. Let's see. That guy. That guy. And... that guy. There's at least four. That one was... They went through a lot of effort on that one. So, I show you that because that's about the most graphic evidence I can give of damnatio memoriae, but that's really how the Egyptians thought of it. That's why I say if Benedict Arnold had been a Soviet, you never would have heard of him at all. Going back to Rome, this is an image of Emperor Septimius Severus. His son, Caracalla, became emperor, and I believe the story was he was the murderer or involved in a plot to murder his brother. So his brother was murdered in 211 AD, and so he wiped out the picture of his brother. You can see, it's erased. Now, they didn't have the technology to do what Stalin did, but this is... same idea, Roman style. So there was another emperor, and I just read about him last week, too late to put in here, and I can't even remember who it was now, but there was an actual emperor whose image was erased by his successor. Don't remember. Ancient Egypt. I don't know how many of you may have heard of Hatshepsut. Yeah? Great. Who was Hatshepsut? Yep. She was a pharaoh. And what was... special about Hatshepsut? She was a girl, right. She was a female pharaoh. And so she was a wife of a pharaoh of Tutmosis II. No, I'm sorry, daughter of Tutmosis II and the wife aunt of Tutmosis III. Don't ask. It's kind of weird. But... yeah, it was Egypt. That's say no more, yeah. So, subsequent to her, the successor wiped out... I think they couldn't handle having a female pharaoh, is the theory. So, they wiped out... They did a number, and you know, they wiped out her image, wiped out every mention of her name. Well, everyone they could find. It's hard to be thorough. So, we still know who she was. But anyway, these are some images of her... very much in the form of a male pharaoh. When you see images, you cannot tell she's female at all. She's even got the false beard on. So you really have no indication that she's female. But anyway, they wiped out anywhere they could her image so precisely that you can really tell the form of it, which is at least nice, I guess. One last example. Name the first pharaoh you can think of other than Hatshepsut. I just mentioned her. Tutankhamun. Ramses. Yeah. Probably the two most commonly known pharaohs. I think probably King Tut is even more well known than Ramses, probably. The question is, why is King Tut so well known? And The reason is because, of course, we found his tomb, the only tomb we've ever found intact. Why did we find his tomb intact? Every other tomb has always been robbed, every royal tomb. His is the only royal tomb that we've ever found intact. The curses? No. It adds to the mystique, but the curses are just a big legend. They're just blown out by an overactive 1920s press. Under construction? No. Yeah, in fact, in a sense, that's true. He died young and was relatively obscure. But the fact is, with that amount of gold, young or obscure, would you love to have your hands on that kind of gold? In fact, by the way, it goes to show you a little bit about the wealth of Egypt. When you look at the fabulous gold that was found in his tomb and then think he was young, relatively unimportant, relatively obscure, and a very hastily buried tomb. They like cobbled together what they could. And that's the gold they came up with. It was amazing. So think about Ramses' tomb, or one of the really great pharaohs. It would have been incredible. But in any case, the reason why you know who Tutankhamun was is because his tomb was discovered intact. The reason it was intact is because nobody ever knew he existed, because his memory had been erased. So he was the subject of Damnatio Memoriae. So much so, more so than Hatshepsut, because he died young and his reign was pretty short. So much so, they went through, they found the Egyptians had every mention of his name, his cartouche, which is the little oval where they have royal names, wiped them all out, to the extent that in the 1800s, archaeologists have said, the Valley of the Kings is played out. We've now found every tomb. They had the list of all the pharaohs. They found all the tombs. They're all accounted for. They said, there's none. We've never found, but there's not going to be one found intact. Until, on the antiquities market, a cartouche came up with a pharaoh that nobody had ever heard of. And people were understandably pretty skeptical. And in any case, Howard Carter was he was kind of into sleuthing, and he was also an extremely accomplished archaeologist. Well, he was convinced that this unknown pharaoh, Tutankhamun, that nobody knew anything about, still had a tomb out there. And he made it his life's work to find it, which he did. So the only reason why it wasn't robbed is because nobody, even the grave robbers, didn't know he existed. So why did nobody know he existed? Because he had been wiped out by his successor, who was a high priest named Ai, who took over the throne. We believe probably murdered Tutankhamun's younger sister, because she would have determined by who she married who became pharaoh. We think he might have married her and then killed her. There's good evidence that she was murdered. And then he became the new pharaoh of a new dynasty. And that kind of ushered in the 19th dynasty. And so he wanted to make sure that he covered his tracks, because this is a palace coup that we've been talking about. There were coups. And so he wiped out Tutankhamun's memory, which kind of backfired, really, because the whole idea of Damnatio Memoriae is that you curse their memory for all of eternity, and that's an eternal spiritual act you're doing on them. And in doing so, he set in motion a 3,500-year avalanche that caused Tutankhamun to be the most well-known pharaoh in history. You're right, he was not playing the long game, because by wiping out his memory, he ensured that he would be the only tomb found intact. So kind of backfired on him. Because they were pretty well guarded during the following dynasty. It was very powerful. They were well guarded during that time. But centuries later, as Egypt declined, they could no longer protect them. And in fact, Tutankhamun's tomb was found under the rubble caused by the construction of Ramses' tomb. So when Howard Carter went to find it, he actually found it underneath the rubble. So in any case, that's why it was lost and now found. Correct. Most of it is from Kush. Yep. Or war, either of which proves that they had an extremely powerful economy. They could either buy it or fight for it. Either one cost money.
Yeah.
Well, they were interested in power. They were not interested in empire per se or in colonization, but there were definitely times, 18th and 19th dynasty, when they would send out their armies way up into Canaan. They took over Canaan a lot. But they never had an empire the size of Assyria or Babylon. They were not that aggressive. So they were good at war, but you're right. They never had this expansive, all-encompassing empire. So I think mostly their wealth really was from trade and from the economy. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Extremely powerful economy. And always had been, which is why also it was the target for other empires to take over. The Persians took it over, the Libyans, the Kushites, the Greeks, and the Romans. And then since then, the Arabs, the British, and they've been taken over a lot since they lost their power. They kind of, sort of, never get involved in a land war in Asia. Well, there's some other geopolitical factors that have precipitated their decline, but we won't go into those. But very, very powerful economy. So Moses refers to Pharaoh 162 times, never names him, and that's why. So Moses is waging, really God is waging spiritual warfare, and that's the theme of this whole lesson today, is God is waging spiritual warfare on behalf of his covenant people, who are his spiritual and physical covenant people. And so sometimes we tend to think of the Exodus event, people interpret it as, well, it was God's physical salvation for his physical covenant, foreshadowing spiritual salvation for a new spiritually covenant people. And that is just wrong. That's not a proper understanding of covenant. That's more of a two covenant. Like, well, God had a physical covenant, now he's got a spiritual covenant, and you discarded that one. Not true. And that's why I keep referring to, we are the children of Israel. There's one covenant. And his covenant with Israel was every bit as spiritual as the covenant is today. Every bit. So his covenant with Israel was a physical covenant and a spiritual covenant. And so God is waging spiritual warfare against Pharaoh on behalf of his covenant people. And Abraham was saved by faith. It was a spiritual faith. When God made the covenant with Abraham, it was a spiritual covenant and a physical covenant, as it is today. We tend to lose the spiritual covenant aspect of back then, and we tend to minimize or lose the fact that the covenant has physical aspects today, that God keeps his promises in every way. So that's kind of the theme for today. So God is waging spiritual warfare. Moses names him, and this is our first indication, if you were back then and you understood Egypt in ancient times, that'd be when you hear him always referring to as Pharaoh, Pharaoh, Pharaoh. What that's screaming out, you're my enemy, and I'm going to wipe out your memory for eternity. Later on, pharaohs are named, only really two, Pharaoh Necho and Pharaoh Hophra. This is in 2 Kings and in Jeremiah, well into the Assyrian period. In the Assyrian period, the culture had reversed because the Assyrians are more like us. They remember their enemies, they name them. Okay, they make sure that they remain infamous for all of eternity by preserving their memory. So that's what the prophets are doing late in history. There are a lot of examples in this. So for example, Exodus 17, then the Lord said to Moses, I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. That's Damnatio Memoriae. Okay, God is waging war on Amalek, and he's saying, I will utterly blot out their memory. Hosea, this is a little bit later in Israelite history, but it's still, at that point, it's still the same idea. For I will remove the names of the Baals from her mouth, and they shall be remembered by name no more. Zechariah, also a little bit later in Israelite history, but same idea. And on that day declares the Lord of hosts, I will cut off the names of the idols from the land, so that they shall be remembered no more. So I bring this up just because it is counter to our culture, that we kind of have to be conscious of that, or else we kind of lose what's going on. The opposite is also true. When God does name people, that's indicative. And we talked a lot about that in the last few months. But here's another example. Moses preserves the names of Joseph's Egyptian wife. Her name is Asenath. And his father-in-law. In Exodus 1, we're told, "Then the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other Puah." Now, if anybody else has any ideas as to the significance of why they are named, let me know, because I'm always sure there's multifaceted reasons. But the only one that I can think of is that he's contrasting the king of Egypt is not named, but the two Hebrew midwives are named. So two Hebrew midwives of enslaved people are more spiritually significant than the Pharaoh. So Pharaoh, enemy, these people, friends. So that's the idea there. In Exodus 20, "In every place where I cause my name to be remembered, I will come to you and bless you." So here God is saying he's going to cause his name to be remembered, but Pharaoh's is wiped out. Psalm 83, "They say, come, let us wipe them out as a nation. Let the name of Israel be remembered no more." These are Israel's enemies trying to wipe out. So they associate wiping out Israel with wiping out her memory. And in Psalm 45, God says, "I will cause your name to be remembered in all generations. Therefore, nations will praise you forever and ever." So the enemies of the covenant people are trying to wipe out their memory. God is preserving it. Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah, especially it's interesting you point out a Russian example because that's what they do. Yeah, yeah, but you're right. It is still very much a cultural thing. Alex? Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's kind of disturbing to me. You celebrate the infamous. And it can either glorify or... I just find it interesting because I'm interested in World War II and that sort of thing, but how Adolf Hitler is treated in today's culture... certainly not glorified, and then so like they tend to glorify the leftist terrorists like Che Guevara, but Hitler is so much remembered that we almost lose what actually happened, which is actually scary because we're almost vulnerable to the same type of thing because we tend to remember him as like he's one of the, you know, if you mention somebody evil, Hitler's name immediately comes up. Everybody remembers him, but in fact we almost know nothing about him. And we tend to forget, like, the methods that he used, the political methods, the popularity, the speeches, how popular he was when he came into political power. We're almost vulnerable to falling into the same thing. Because, we now tend to think as soon as he came out of the womb, he must have had a little sign that said Satan on him. But when people elected him, he was a popular, enthusiastic, charismatic young guy, all for change. But anyway... I'm sorry, he was. That's just, I'm letting that show through. But anyway. Sorry, Mark.
But they've also successfully painted them as supposed to be the right wing.
Yeah.
That's why they call him like that, because they qualify as more conservative side, when in fact he was not.
Yeah. That's yeah, excellent point. It's absolutely true. Because we forget that he was a national socialist. So he was, yeah. You're absolutely right. So.
Yeah, I wonder, I grew up watching Sergeant York, the movie there. And you know, Audie Murphy. I don't think the young people today hear about those heroes, mm-hmm. about that. But they think for the various notorious people from other countries as if they're someone who looked up to them.
Yeah. absolutely. My view is if you're going to, I think it's just my personal, teach the kids first about real heroes, godly heroes, and then men of virtue after that, you know, even if they're not Christian, but men of virtue after the godly heroes, and teach them about the villains last, and for goodness sake, teach them as real. Teach them like they really were, not the gobbledygook that we've turned it into, but excellent point. So, God is waging war on Pharaoh. What does the word Pharaoh mean? Pharaoh is an Egyptian word, means it's Pa-Ra. And that's where we get it from Egyptian into Hebrew and then in English, and gets a little turned into Pharaoh. But Pa-Ra in Egyptian means big house, not the prison. Not that kind of big house. Or touchdown, yeah. It was actually used just like, exactly like today, people say the White House has proclaimed blah, blah, blah. It's exactly how it's used. What that means is the presidential administration. So the word Pharaoh, think of it just like saying White House. I mean, I'm not saying God has declared spiritual war on the White House, but I mean, the phrase is used in the same way. So it's referring to not just Pharaoh the person, but Pharaoh's role as Horus on earth, God on earth, savior of his people. Kind of every way that we think of Christ is how they thought of Pharaoh. Pharaoh's the seed of the woman. That's why we talked about this a while ago, about the mythology. Remember, Pharaoh is the seed of the woman. He's Horus on earth. Horus is the seed of Isis and Osiris. So he is the savior of his people. He is God incarnate. He is the one that pacifies the rest of the gods. He is your link, Egypt's link with the gods. And so Pharaoh, as Horus on earth, as almost literally Horus incarnate, it is Pharaoh's job to keep Egypt running. So if Egypt falls apart, if things don't remain in harmony, it's Pharaoh's fault. That is his job description. That's going to become really important when we talk about the plagues, because God is obliterating Pharaoh systematically. So this is really a war of the worldviews. It's spiritual warfare. And so I want to emphasize over and over, the whole point of all of this is God is waging spiritual warfare with Israel's covenant enemies, because God has a spiritual covenant with Israel. It's not just a physical foreshadowing of something he's going to do long later. There's only one covenant. We're in that covenant. We are that covenant with Abraham. And it's a spiritual covenant back then, and it is now. And God's salvation is both spiritual and physical. We should not think that just because God physically saved Israel, that therefore there must have been devoid of any spiritual aspect. It's not one or the other. It's both. God physically saves Israel because he spiritually is saving Israel. So, let's get to the serpent confrontation. Let's dive into the spiritual warfare. And we're told in Exodus 7, the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "When Pharaoh says to you, 'Prove yourself by working a miracle,' then you shall say to Aaron, 'Take your staff and cast it down before Pharaoh, that it may become a serpent.' So Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and did just as the Lord commanded. Aaron cast down his staff before Pharaoh and his servants, and it became a serpent. Then the Pharaoh summoned the wise men and the sorcerers, and they, the magicians of Egypt, also did the same by their secret arts." And we talked earlier about how these words, wise men, sorcerers, magician, are kind of from later culture. They're sort of Hebrew words that we've pulled out. Some of them are more of Persian origin. But if you traced it back to Egypt, they would have been the lector priests. They would have been the Egyptian priests who served Pharaoh in his court. And I say that because magician is really a Persian word. But these would have been Egyptian priests. And so they also did the same by their secret arts. For each man cast down his staff and they became serpents. But Aaron's staff swallowed up their staffs. Still, Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he would not listen to them, as the Lord had said. Now, I always found it striking that Pharaoh was so unimpressed. Because if somebody turned a staff into a snake, I would be impressed. Even if I was the emperor, I'd be impressed. So then he's like, "Oh, that's nothing. Come on, guys. Come on in here. You do the same thing." Apparently, it's like the old snake trick. Apparently, everybody knows it. I don't know. What's going on here? So So then God wins the battle, not just by turning the staff into a snake, but by having Aaron's snake eat all of their snakes. So they have to go that extra step. And so there's a lot been said in commentaries about, how does this happen? People have said, oh, it's the power of Satan. And they get a little weird on this, in my humble opinion. Demonic powers. They were dabbling in the occult so much that they were able to harness the powers of Satan and the demons so that they could turn their staff into a real snake. And honestly, in my biblical world, in my understanding of Scripture and Satan and demons and that, they can't create things. So this just always kind of set the wrong way with me. I think they're giving a little too much power to Satan. I don't think Satan is able to turn something into a living being. Honestly, maybe I'm wrong with that, but that just always struck me as being giving way too much credit to Satan.
And you're taking into account that Satan
has
much better power.
That's my take on it, because I think really only God creates. Now, was it an illusion? Yeah, I think Satan could cause an illusion like that, no doubt. So maybe it was Satan causing an illusion. And I don't want to get dogmatic on it, but let me give you something that we have now found out from Egyptology. They had staffs. They were shaped like serpents. Here's one of them. The idea is that they had, the sorcerers, the priests, would have a staff with a head on it like that, and it would be shaped like a cobra. And we'll talk about the symbolism of the cobra in a minute. But they would carry around these staffs. And so, you know, almost all the time it was a real staff. Well, we also happen to know, and Professor Bob Breyer is an Egyptologist that I like a lot, and when he's been to Egypt, there have been times, there was one time in particular when he visited a snake charmer. And the snake charmer was doing all these things with a cobra, maybe devenomized or whatever, but it was a real cobra. And one of the things that he did is he took the cobra and wrapped him up into a crown, and he put him on his head, and the cobra just became stiff, and the cobra's head was sticking out of the front, just like on the pharaoh's uraeus crown. You know how the pharaoh always had the cobra sticking out the front? Well, that's what the snake charmer did, and this is in the late 20th century. Another thing that he did is Professor Breyer asked him if he could turn his snake into a staff, and the guy said, oh yeah, no problem. And he pinched the cobra in some places, like around the neck, probably not all that pleasant for the cobra. But all of a sudden, the cobra went into this trance, stuck out completely straight, and you would have thought it was a staff. He used him as a walking staff. Threw him on the ground, back to slithering around. They had figured out a way to do that, to put the snake into that kind of a trance. Well, when you combine the evidence, if these lecture priests had that art that has even come down to today, and they're carrying around a staff that looks like a serpent. But now when Pharaoh calls them in, says, hey, serpent trick, swap out the staff for a real cobra, put it into a trance, you come in, nobody's really the wiser because your normal staff looks like a cobra. You come in, cast it down, poof, it's a snake. Because it was always a snake when you came in. It's an illusion. But a pretty well-crafted one. So I think that's what it was. I think we have kind of two sides to this. We know that you can do that with a snake, and we now know that they carried cobra staffs. So seems to make sense. So then we can see that when Aaron's staff really turned into a snake, now they were all really snakes, and now God is defeating Pharaoh by his snake eating up all the other snakes. And I always wondered, I wasn't sure if it was like killing them or actually physically consuming them. I don't know, but I think that's what was going on. Now, what's the significance of all of this? Why the snake trick? Well, the serpent Uraeus was a goddess in Egypt. She was considered the protector of Pharaoh, and Pharaoh is the protector of Egypt. So that's why Pharaoh always had this. And that the name of the goddess is called Wajit. And she is the goddess of Lower Egypt. The vulture, I'm trying to remember the vulture's name. Can't remember, sorry. He's the god of Upper Egypt, one of the guardians of Upper Egypt. But if you think about it, you know, the The cobra is able to kill very quickly, blind and kill, and then the vulture eats dead things. So they're kind of the protectors. They're basically reasons why you should be scared of Pharaoh, because his gods and goddesses can blind you, kill you, and eat you. Okay, so wipe out. When you think in the Egyptian worldview, when you get eaten, you have now wiped that out from existence. So eating something or devouring it is symbolic of that damnatio memoria, of wiping it out from existence. So that we'll come back to that. But we have this, this is one address we have. It's a magical address when Pharaoh was coronated. He would address the serpent Uraeus crown. This is called the Uraeus crown. And he would address it with these words, O red crown, O Inu, O great one, O magician, O fiery snake, let there be terror of me like the terror of thee. Let there be fear of me like the fear of thee. Let there be awe of me like the awe of thee. So that's kind of how they thought about this. So when you go before Pharaoh, you're thinking of him as the serpent. And they want you to be afraid of him. Here's another saying that we have from Egyptian writing. Dreadful is thy serpent crest among them, among Pharaoh's enemies. The war mace is in thy right hand. And now we find the prophets referring to Pharaoh using this serpent phraseology. In Ezekiel, he says, this is what the sovereign Lord says. I am against you, Pharaoh, king of Egypt, you great serpent lying among your streams. You say the Nile is mine. I made it for myself. So God refers to him as a serpent. So the serpent is really tied up with the deity of Pharaoh and with his whole job description. The statement's what? He brood of vipers? Oh, you brood of vipers. When Jesus is, or John the Baptist is talking to the Pharisees. Well, I think so. In Hebrew language, in that time of the New Testament, the serpent really come down as a negative creature who is generally associated with evil. And that goes right back to Genesis 3, you know, the seed of the serpent. And I'm sure a lot of it comes down from the Israelite memory from Egypt, where Pharaoh was the seed of the serpent, literally in their myth, in their worldview. He was the seed of the serpent as being kind of a good thing. Because, I mean, he was the seed of the woman. He was Horus, the seed of Isis and Osiris. And he had this association with serpents. So I'm sure there was that association carried on down. In Israelites, serpents were always bad. John Currid says this, I think, pretty succinctly and well. He says the hostilities were not primarily between Moses and Pharaoh, or even between Moses and the Egyptian magicians, or for that matter, between Israel and Egypt. What the serpent contest portrays is a heavenly combat, a war between God of the Hebrews and the deities of Egypt. This is spiritual warfare, because the serpent represents in every way the Pharaoh. So when you eat Pharaoh's serpent, it's kind of like you're eating Pharaoh. And later on, well, in fact, Moses uses the language that Pharaoh and his army were eaten up, were devoured, or were swallowed by the Red Sea. So Pharaoh ends up getting swallowed later. So in Exodus and in Numbers, Moses goes out of his way to proclaim that the war is on the gods of Egypt, not just on a man, not just on one bad guy. It's a worldview war. On all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgments. I am the Lord. And then in Numbers he says, on their gods also the Lord executed judgments. So this is very much spiritual warfare. Now that's the deal with the serpent. We see over and over Pharaoh's heart getting hardened. What's the deal with that? That actually also speaks very much into Egyptian culture. So I'm not going to read all of these, but I think you kind of get the idea. These are all of the repetition of Pharaoh's heart being hardened. So starting in Exodus 7, Pharaoh's heart was hardened. Ah, now, Exodus 9. The Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh. So before, Pharaoh's hardening his own heart. And now we shift into the Lord is now hardening his heart. And if you want an exposition on that, go to Romans. But now the Lord is hardening his heart. He sinned again and hardened his heart. So the heart of Pharaoh was hardened. I have hardened his heart and the hearts of his servants. Now even his servants' hearts are being hardened. Let's see. The Lord hardened. Yeah. So lots of hardening of hearts. But it kind of shifts over from they're doing it to themselves to now God is taking over. And really, at that point, condemning them to, okay, you've made your bed. Now you can sleep in it. Now God is going to harden your heart. And we're going to bring this all the way through to completion. God is not even allowing Pharaoh's fear to get him out of this. Because we'll find out Pharaoh, almost at least at some point, his fear of God almost saves him, prevents him from pursuing Israel. But then God makes sure he brings him to total destruction. God hardens his heart so that he now continues and goes out after Israel and results in destruction. Now, in the Egyptian worldview, that's really significant. So again, Moses is, this whole narrative is crafted largely in light of the Egyptian worldview. This is a scene from the Book of the Dead, and it's called the heart weighing scene. So what happens is after the Pharaoh dies, he goes to the land of the dead, which is ruled by Osiris, and his heart is weighed. And so he talks, Pharaoh, the dead Pharaoh, will now tell all of the bad things that he has not done. I haven't done this, I haven't committed murder, I haven't done this, I haven't done that. And his heart is put right here on the scales. And Osiris, I think I have a picture of Osiris. Yeah, here's Osiris. So Osiris is presiding over this judgment of the dead. And what's going on here is you have Anubis. He's the jackal-headed god of the dead. So he's in charge of the whole weighing. Here's another Anubis over here. Osiris is presiding over the whole affair. You have Thoth. Thoth is the god of the ibis-headed god of wisdom. And so he is the scribe. He's writing down exactly what happens. He's kind of the clerk of the session or whatever. And what's on the other side? This is a feather. And the feather is a symbol of Ma'at. And that's why we talked last week about the Egyptian worldview. Remember we talked about Ma'at? It's Pharaoh's job to maintain Ma'at. And Ma'at was a god, actually a god with a head of a feather, human body with a feather head. And his job was Ma'at represents harmony, balance, order, continuity. In short, the way things should be. So that's Ma'at. And so Pharaoh's heart is being weighed opposite a feather, representing Ma'at, representing the way things should be. So that's what Pharaoh's job is, to maintain Ma'at. And so after he's dead, his heart has to be light as a feather. And you see in this case, you know, of course it is, because it's up a little bit higher on the scales. And so you have Anubis running the scales and Thoth watching, see which one's higher. And if his heart is as light as Ma'at, is as light as a feather, then he goes into eternal bliss. And he goes and becomes a god, still is a god because he was a god on earth, but he now goes become a heavenly god. So he becomes a star or something like that. Now, who is this scary guy? If his heart is not light as a feather, then Amit, this beast, eats up the heart, and he's appropriately called the devourer of hearts. And so that's eternal judgment. And so he gets obliterated for all of eternity from memory by being consumed. So it's that idea of eating consumption that obliterates the heart. Now, of course, pharaohs never suffered that death, right? Because pharaohs are always doing the right thing in their worldview. They don't write down, oh, this was a bad pharaoh. But when you see them wipe out the memory of somebody like Hatshepsut or Tutankhamun, that's kind of what they're doing. They're, in a sense, devouring their memory. Later on in Egyptian history, this became applicable really to everybody. Early on, it was just the pharaohs that went into the land of the dead of Osiris, but later on, it got a bit more egalitarian. Everybody would get a chance, you know. So this was kind of their popular view, and it kind of still is with ours. You know, if you just talk to your average person, what happens when you die? Well, I go to the pearly gates, and then Peter judges all my good things versus my bad things on the scale, and if my good things outweigh the bad things, then he lets me in. And that's kind of our Christian version of this pagan myth, honestly. That's really not a good belief. So that's what's going on here. Now here we have some, this is actually from the Metropolitan Museum of Art from the Met in New York City, and this is I was kind of excited because I took this picture myself. But they have a Book of the Dead. And if you go there, really, if you go to New York City, go to this museum and go to the Egypt section. They have a Book of the Dead that's about as wide, almost as wide as this room. And it's about two or three layers high. They have one here and one here and one here. And it's really neat. You can go through the whole thing and you'll see all of this. You'll see it written out, and then you'll also see it drawn out. And so these pictures are from that. And so this is what's going on, the same scene. Here's Ra, and here's Anubis. And Anubis is presiding over the weighing. And here's the heart of Pharaoh, and here's Maat, again, that goddess with a feather for a head. And here's Toth recording it. So that's what's going on there. So what God is doing is when God judges Pharaoh, and he keeps saying he hardened his heart, the word hardened, if you look at that in a Hebrew or an Egyptian context, that word really kind of can be equated with being heavy. His heart was made heavy. Because in Egyptian, those are kind of similar, kind of the same concepts. When God is making Pharaoh's heart hard, in a sense, he's making his heart heavy. And so what God is saying is, I am judging your heart, and your heart's too heavy. And you're going to be obliterated. And here's the guy who's waiting to obliterate it. This is Ammit. This is in the Book of the Dead at the Met in New York City. And so that's pretty scary. So he's sitting there waiting to devour hearts. So the whole Exodus narrative plays out in terms that Egyptians would understand. God is judging Pharaoh's heart. Pharaoh's heart is being made too heavy. And then God swallows up Pharaoh in the Red Sea. So this is all a spiritual judgment upon, not just on Pharaoh, again, not on Pharaoh the man, but on Pharaoh the god. Judgment on the gods of Egypt. God's actually literally swallowing up the gods of Egypt, destroying them one by one, and then swallowing them to obliterate all memory. There's another little, maybe a side to this, is that when Pharaoh commands that the first Israelite firstborn be thrown into the Nile, the worst death that an Egyptian could possibly imagine is being eaten by a crocodile. Because you're being devoured. You're not just dead, you're gone for eternity. Remember, when you die in Egyptian, they're resurrectionists. They're looking forward, you've got to preserve my corpse and mummify me. But if you get eaten by a croc, you're gone for eternity. That's it. That's the worst death imaginable. So when we think, although it doesn't say, you can kind of read in, throw the firstborn into the Nile, what's going to happen to them? They're going to get eaten. There are going to be crocs there waiting. And so that's really Pharaoh judging Israel, having their firstborn get devoured in the Nile, and now God is devouring Pharaoh. Not only that, he's devouring all the gods. So when we see Aaron's staff swallowing up the serpents of the magicians, that's supreme judgment. Okay? Yeah, they turned their staffs into snakes, but my snake ate your snakes. So the idea of eating something up, that is, Pharaoh is the serpent. That serpent represents Pharaoh's deity. Represents Pharaoh's power, his ability to protect Egypt, and my God's staff just ate your snake, destroying it for all of eternity. So that's what's going on there. The little serpent confrontation is supreme spiritual warfare. We're actually closing on the end. Oh my goodness, we might almost get done early or on time. Yeah, I think I've already gone through this stuff. But the battle starts. This is the opening salvo, is the serpent confrontation. Opening salvo with a direct assault on Pharaoh's power and his authority, on his very ability to protect Egypt or to protect himself with swallowing that snake, that serpent confrontation. And then it goes downhill from there for Pharaoh. You have the plagues, which we'll talk about Egypt, and those are one by one systematically destroying Egypt's gods. And we'll talk about that next week, what those mean in the Egyptian worldview. And then it culminates at the Red Sea with Pharaoh hunting down the Israelites with an army of chariots. And remember, we talked about chariots versus a whole bunch of families on foot. It would have just been suicide. and God turns that into the ultimate destruction. Pharaoh's whole army is swallowed up. Doesn't even use the word necessarily drowned. They're swallowed. And that's the significance of that. So full-scale spiritual warfare on the gods of Egypt. And so that's why I emphasize the whole, as you think about this, the whole point is not only warfare on Egypt, but warfare on the gods of Egypt in the same way that God wages spiritual warfare today on the gods of our culture. And when we think of the Exodus, we should really think that God is saving his spiritual, physical and spiritual salvation for his covenant people. And I'll end with this verse from Ephesians 6. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. That's what's going on. That is probably the best recap possible of the Exodus event as an act of spiritual warfare. And so you notice when I keep emphasizing the fact that it's one covenant, we're in the covenant with Abraham and we're the children of Israel, that's the backdrop for all of this. Good. Oh, I've been going on a little too long. I was hoping somebody would have a question.
I like this question. This account was written after it happened. Mm-hmm. So they've been delivered. They're out of Egypt. Why is it written as if to an Egyptian? Because while they were in captivity, they were kept separate out of the plot. They were kept more of their own culture around.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah, excellent. It's an excellent question. I think, and to some point we get into speculation because we're not told directly. But I think during the 215 years in which they're in Egypt, they are very familiar with Egyptian culture. I think they are, in Egyptian culture, it's not a syncretistic culture. So unlike in Canaan, there are not huge forces encouraging them to intermarry with the Egyptians or to participate in that. But I think they would have been intimately familiar with the worldview around them. Much like we are today, we have a biblical culture, and we really try and reject syncretism, but are we familiar with the culture around us? Absolutely. So I think in a sense it'd be kind of like God speaking directly to our culture. Well, in a sense it is. And we would understand that, even though we're hopefully not participating in it. But I honestly think some Israelites were participating in it. You could look at the golden calf incident and interpret that as some Egyptian paganism playing out. We also know that later on in Israelite, from archaeology, we've actually found Egyptian gods, particularly Hathor, became the bull god, became fairly popular in Canaan, both with Israelites and with Phoenicians. And we found, Hathor idols in Canaan. Not so much because the Egyptians exported it, because they didn't care, but because the Canaanites and later on the Israelites were so syncretistic, they were just pulling in other, and because the bull was very significant in terms of Canaanite and Israelite culture, so they were like, oh, there's an Egyptian bull goddess, Hathor. So they pulled her in. So I think that's what's going on. Believe it or not, that's the last chart. We finished. I didn't think we would. Mark the day on the calendar. All right. Sure, go ahead. I don't know. I actually don't know if the replicas were rideable. The replica of King Tut's chariot was for display purposes. I don't know if any of them are rideable. More or less, I don't know if anybody would actually be trained, because driving one was not easy. Yeah, yeah, that would be a fascinating experiment, and possibly one that a university might fund. It's a good grant opportunity there. Yes, absolutely.
It would be a great thesis.
It would be an awesome thesis. In fact, some of the theories about King Tut's death are that he died in a chariot accident, that he was thrown. So it was not a safe occupation. But I would imagine they'd probably go about as fast as a galloping horse, I would suppose, basically. Well, let's close there, and we're done on time. Let's not spoil it. Dear Heavenly Father, Hugh waged war against Pharaoh and against the gods of Egypt, and we pray for the sake of your kingdom that you would continue to wage war against those pagan worldviews of today, and that you would equip us as your saints, sons of Israel, daughters of Israel, to be light in a world of darkness, and to wage spiritual warfare and warfare against worldviews, but not warfare against people, for we're all sinners and in need of your blood and your redemption. And so we pray that we'd be good witnesses for you. In Christ's name, amen.